she's no longer the enfant terrible of American criticism who helped make camp into a cult during the swinging 60s and produced American versions of the nouveau roman. But then she was always a more serious person than she'd been taken for, especially in this country. Her reputation here has never quite recovered from the unfortunate introduction she received to British audiences. This was on the first edition of the BBC One art series Monitor under its new editor, Jonathan Miller. Her pretentious conversation with Dr. Miller about the state of contemporary culture and the new artistic sensibility was intended to signal the change in Monitor's character from the staid presentation of Hugh Weldon. Instead, it was mocked in the press, parodied on the following Saturday evening's satire show by Eleanor Bron and John Baird, and became a byword for bogus cultural discourse. This was unfortunate, and has helped conceal from us that Miss Sontag is one of the most perceptive and intellectually daring critics and social observers we have. Her collections of essays, Against Interpretation and Styles of Radical Will, didn't get their due here in the 1960s, nor have her novels, or the feature film she directed in Sweden. This last year, after a period of silence, she's published two books, and there's a collection of stories soon to appear. The most recent of these books, Illness as Metaphor, is an expansion of a lecture she gave at New York University. It's a brilliant, incisive study of the way in which writers, politicians, and philosophers have used disease, most particularly TB and cancer, as a metaphor for social and political malaise. What isn't revealed on the jacket or in the text is that it arose out of her own brave and painful battle against cancer over these past 2 years, in the face of which she's demonstrated an extraordinary resilience. The other book is On Photography, a collection of essays she's been contributing to the New York Review of Books since 1972. It treats the way photography has changed our perception of the world, how it relates to art, how the degradation of Walt Whitman's sense of democratic affirmation has been reflected in the change of the photographer's vision in America, and so on. It's an impossible book to summarize, packed with dazzling insights, often expressed in the form of elegant aphorisms. There are no illustrations, but there is an appendix of quotations of what people have said about photography from Elizabeth Browning to Agatha Christie. The essays have been appearing during a period in which her fellow Americans have become increasingly interested in photography as an art form, and her austere book became a surprise bestseller, with well over 80,000 copies in print, an astonishing figure for a collection of reflective pieces. I discussed the book with Susan Sontag in her New York apartment some weeks ago, and I began by asking her whether she herself took pictures or was addicted to photography.
No, I'm addicted to photographs. If it is an addiction, and I think it is, that is to say, I've always looked at photographs, been fascinated by them, cut them out of newspapers and magazines and had them on the walls and gone to photography shows. In fact, someone pointed out to me that there are quite a few references to the photographic image, both directly and as a metaphor, in many things that I've written, in fiction particularly. But I don't use a camera. I don't. I own one, actually, because someone gave me one, but I don't take pictures myself.
The book is as much about society as about photography. So is it a way of looking at society? Was this deliberate, or was this something that came about?
No, that was there from the beginning. In other words, though the book is called On Photography, it isn't really on photography. That already is a very vast subject. To write about photography, though, is really to write about the world and about changes in consciousness and perception and attitudes toward experience and toward reality. And that the phenomenon of photography, of the taking of pictures and the looking at pictures and receiving so much of one's sense of the world through these disembodied images, was a way of talking about society and modern consciousness. That definitely was the intention from the beginning. It's not a book of photographic criticism. It, in fact, presupposes that people have looked at photographs, are interested in photography already. The activities connected with photography and facilitated and promoted by photography make it an exemplary activity. It's part of a process in which there is a very sophisticated technology for changing our way of perceiving things and understanding our experience. And this technological revolution also includes newspapers. It also includes radio, television, of course, which is partly an extension of the photographic image. It includes tape recorders and phonographs and all these processes for replicating, reproducing, miniaturizing, and diffusing information and experience. But I think the phenomenon of photography is still the central one and the model, and it's also interesting not only for its larger social implications, but as a model in the arts, because I want to talk about that too. I don't want to deny that photography can be used to produce works of art, but it's much more than a phenomenon of the arts.
I mean, in this book, you do seem more interested in photography as a medium than photography as an art, and you seem rather suspicious of many of the claims made for it as art.
Well, I think it's more than an art. A great many of my examples come from the famous art photographers whose work never ceases to delight me. But I think photography is more than an art form, and I think it's part of the mythology of photography of some professional photographers, members of the photography establishment, to restrict it to that. The question is not, as people thought for many generations, is photography an art? That is, can it produce works of art? Of course it can. Obviously it can. But the real question is, how has photography changed our idea of art? Because I think that is also one of its effects.
But you do suggest there can't really be any adequate canons of judgment for photography, and that authorship lies in subject matter and not in style, and that this is being muddied, I suppose, one might say, by the way in which photography and photographers are presented in museums and art galleries.
Well, I think there are two different points. There is a phenomenon which I don't fully understand myself, which has to do with the question of judgment. I think it is much more difficult to erect standards of judgment for photography considered as an art form than it is for other arts. The model of the still photograph, the photographic image. I know that. Well, even let's take an example. Movies are an outgrowth of photography in the sense that one of the elements of the film is the photographic image. But the film is also something that exists in time. It has narration. It usually has sound. It usually has a dramatic structure. It has many other things besides the photographic image. And I think our ability to erect standards of judgment, perhaps more of a comparative than an absolute kind, but nevertheless to have a clear idea of why Godard is a greater filmmaker than Truffaut, a judgment that I think no serious filmgoer could argue with. At any rate, that is, I could myself explain why Godard is a greater or more important filmmaker than Truffaut. I don't mean each film of Godard's. I mean the total body of work is more important, more valuable, more profound than the body of work produced by Truffaut. I do not know how to explain why the work of Atje is greater or more profound than the work of Walker Evans, or vice versa. The reason I think it's harder to explain, to account for judgments or preferences in photography as such, as opposed to things which use the element of photography like film, is because there is something ambiguous or dual, irrevocably dual, about the photographic image. That is to say, it is an image. It clearly is an image. And it can be judged according to the standards of images, that is the same standards that we apply to painting. But it is also something more than an image. It's a trace. It is a trace of reality, and everybody understands that. Though certain photographers like to say, no, it must be considered just as an image, there is the fact that a painting of a horse race would never be used to settle a bet about who won the horse race, but a photo finish photograph of a horse race could settle a bet. And the fact that we understand why a photograph could settle a bet or be used as evidence in court, whereas a painting could not, means that everyone understands that a photograph is representational. It is evidentiary. It is a piece of evidence. It is a trace of reality in a way that a painting or a drawing is not. So I don't want to say that a photograph is only of its subject, or the only criteria of photography are so-called realistic criteria, but we're really thinking about the subject when we are evaluating the photograph. But the consideration of the subject enters into photography, I think, into a photograph, into our reaction to a photograph, in a way that it doesn't with a drawing or a painting or even a film. I think there is a considerable body of film criticism that's been written over the past 50 years. And film, after all, is a younger form than photography as such. And you don't have in still photography anything comparable to the attempt to write works of critical overview, established principles like those works like those of Arnheim and Krakauer and Metz and other people who have worked in film. I think for a simple and also extremely mysterious reason that when you are writing about photography, you are not just writing about artists and their bodies of work, but you are writing about the world.
Is this something that you had in mind when you said that the best writers on photography are modelists?
Well, the ones who have interested me most, certainly. I think the person who has written by far the most interesting things about photography in recent years is John Berger. And his approach is one that's guided by certain moral and political views, and as is his criticism of painting. His position, as well as his brilliance as a writer, gives him a focus, a point of approach. I think work like that shows that exclusively aesthetic criteria won't do the job. I suppose that my book also is somewhat of a moralist's book, but in a different sense. I'm assuming the context of capitalist consumer society, and that's the one in which the distinctive uses of photography arise. Toward the end of the book, I compare the way we use photography with the way it's used in a society which is not a consumer society, which has tried to suppress all tendencies in that direction, namely China. But I think that one can't get very far, in fact, by saying simply that, photography and the way we think of photography is a product of capitalism. That almost goes without saying. But one can get rather far, I think, in examining in great detail, trying to understand what this consumerist relationship to reality is that that people experience when they use a camera, when they take a picture, and that the word take is, I think, quite correct. They don't make a picture, they take a picture. When they take a picture, or when a picture is taken of oneself, or when you collect photographs, when you experience things, I'm interested in the detail of that, what happens to, what the implications are for your relationship to reality, for the way you perceive. And I think you can illustrate that in an infinite number of ways. The examples are everywhere.
You mentioned the section on China where you deal particularly with the Chinese response to Antonioni's documentary film about China. Now, what they seem to be denying, in a way, is the surrealist aspect of
right,
photography,
well,
which not only do you, I think, observe correctly that it is the greatest triumph in two ways of surrealism. One is the equalization democratically of all objects and the elevation of chance. Now, you observe that as having happened. It is something that you celebrate in photography.
Well, it's something that endlessly fascinates me and attracts me. I think it's an inevitable implication of the photograph, especially with the passage of time, when a great deal of its most specific reference is drained out of the photograph and it becomes an object, a relic of the past, and something strange and fantastic and poignant. The photographs become beautiful. I think they're promoted by the passage of time, and the way they slice reality and frame it, and their juxtaposition with other photographs make them into fantastic objects, and objects which suggest fantastic relationships which are not part of our direct experience. I would even go farther in talking about China or an anti-consumerist relation to photographs. As much as I criticize implicitly the limitations or deformations of perception institutionalized by photographic images, when you see what happens in an anti-consumer society like China, which is the most rigidly moralistic of societies, you realize that not only do they not have a place for the surrealist, they don't have a place for the aesthetic. There is no place for the aesthetic way of looking at the world. And that makes our scheme of repressions quite trifling, of course, compared to theirs. That is certainly the most repressive society imaginable, precisely because it is only a moralistic society and does not have any place for the aesthetic way of looking at the world, which is represented by photography.
Well, one point in the book, you say that given the choice between a painting of Shakespeare by Holbein, had he lived to paint it, and a photograph of Shakespeare, had photography existed then, most people would prefer the photograph because it would be more useful historically. It would be a form of evidence.
I think it's more than that, because I go even further. I say, even if we had this marvelous Holbein portrait of Shakespeare, as we have of so many of famous English people of the generation earlier, and all that existed, this imaginary proto-photograph of Shakespeare, was something very difficult to read, almost a brown smudge in which we could barely make out the features. I think that most people would be tremendously attracted to the photograph, not because we would see better in the photograph what Shakespeare looked like, but because the photograph has the status of a relic. It is a piece of the true cross. A photograph is, as I said earlier, a trace, in a way. The Holbein portrait of Shakespeare is a trace of Holbein, but the imaginary photograph of Shakespeare would be a trace of Shakespeare, and it isn't. It would be still valuable and fascinating to us, even if it didn't give us much information or gave us less information than possibly such a painting would.
At several points, you talk about the relationship of words to pictures and the need to put them into context, to give them meaning. And one thing that you don't touch on is photojournalism, the way in which this has often led to the gravest kinds of distortion.
Well, I touch on it, let's put it that way. I do mention it a few times, and at one point I talk about it in connection with the idea of truth, that when I'm comparing a photograph and a painting, if we say that a painting is a fake, what we mean is that it is not by the person to whom it is attributed. When a painting is fake, it falsifies the history of painting. We say that a photograph is, we don't say fake, but false or a fabrication. It's not a question of authorship, it's the question of reality. Let's say that this event did not really take place, not that this work is not by the person it's purported to be by. And we all know, of course, how much captions can guide photographs, and photographs have implicit captions. When we learn that the true caption, so to speak, if one can use that term, is not what we think it is, of course we see the photograph quite differently. And I don't think that's at all as true of painting. If you take that famous Robert Capa photograph, which purports to be of a loyalist soldier coming down a slope, having just been shot, the moment of his death, the moment that he's mortally wounded, and find out that it's not a loyal soldier, but a soldier in the Franco army, you could have another reaction to that. The photograph would be less valuable as a kind of a token or symbol of your commitment to a particular cause. It's used in that way as a sentimental icon, as many, many photographs are. The ones that become most famous, some of the most famous photographs of the Vietnam War were used that way. If you find out it's not really a photograph of someone dying, but if someone's slipping, you have a completely different relationship to it. The caption is always terrifically important. But I think we are drawn to the idea of photographs as preserving, as giving us a very peculiar idea of the past, as preserving this instant of the past, that in the way life is way our experience is that it's a process, that one moment is always being succeeded by something else. The photographs freezes this one moment, and it is an object that we can have many relationships to. It becomes both surreal, it becomes something almost abstract, it becomes something purely decorative. I know someone who has that Kappa photograph in his living room wall and looks at it 1,000 times a day. What possible relationship can he have to whatever feelings people had, to say, 30 years ago, 40 years ago when they looked at that photograph? What relationship will people have in another few generations to photographs, that news photographs, journalistic photographs? You see, they aren't journalistic after a while. They're journalistic at the moment they're taken, but then they become part of some idea we have that we can really understand the high moments of drama, the human condition, the what Steichen called the family of man. I think it gives one an unearned sense of understanding things and an unearned relation to the past. What's interesting about photography is it constitutes a kind of objective body of memory that we don't actually have. We can know how our grandparents looked as children. Nobody has ever been able to know that before. We can have a whole sense of ourselves and how we looked and how we have aged. People keep photographs. They look at them. We now have a knowledge of the human face that we couldn't have had before.
The distinction you make is between a painting. You only need one painting, whereas with photographs, they're taken year after year in a family album because they have a quite different role.
Well, we think that we can never have too many photographs, and that the photograph is this ongoing record or this museum of ourselves that we construct. And partly, as I say, it's a knowledge that we have of ourselves, where we see ourselves as in the third person, so to speak, or it's a knowledge that you get of other people, perhaps. That a new friend of mine said to me just the other day, "Oh, when are you going to show me photographs of yourself as a child? I'd love to see what you looked at." People could never have that sense of each other before. And I think to myself, well, what does that mean when someone wants to look at your baby photographs, or when you want to show them to, because I have taken out photographs and shown them to friends. I think it's always an invitation to some kind of sentimentality. Because what you see essentially is the pathos of the past. You say, oh, I was younger then, how innocent I was. I didn't know what was going to happen to me. There's that little face, and there I am facing the world. So bravely, or with tears in my eyes, or looking so silly, or whatever it is, and now all this has happened. Even we look at photographs of 19th century London or New York, there's always a kind of poignancy, a kind of pathos, a kind of sentimentalism, I think, and it's a built-in invitation to nostalgia. We're all filled with nostalgia because of the presence and the constant accumulation of photographs.
You write at the end of the book about the secular society and the way in which, where we might have expected images to disappear, they have suddenly appeared. And you say that the powers of photography have in fact de-Platonized our understanding of reality, making it less and less plausible to reflect upon our experience according to the distinctions between images and things, between copies and originals. Is this a very pessimistic thought to you?
I think there's both a loss and a gain. I do think it's harder and harder for people, and I don't exclude myself when I speak of these reactions. I think it is harder and harder for people to distinguish between images and reality. There are things that we get through images that we don't get through reality. A lot of people say, for instance, sports enthusiasts, of whom I am not one, say that they get a great deal more out of watching a football game or a basketball game, a tennis match on television than they do going to the event. That they see more, that they understand more, that there's more information in the image. There is, for instance, on television, that slow motion replay of key moments in the game and so on. Now that's true. That is a gain. That is a gain in information. Obviously, it has other kinds of long range social implications, that people should have lost these communal possibilities because the sports event had many other meanings than getting information about what's really going on in the game. So I think it's a loss, and in that sense, I guess I'm pessimistic because I think the direction is irreversible. It's a change in consciousness, an incalculably important change in consciousness.